Welcome to this episode of Dublin's Historic South, where I, Laura Fitzacre, will be joined by guest hosts in discovering the townlands of South Dublin and delving into their history by looking at how the Liberties got its name, what life was like in 15th century Shankill, and how Ball's Bridge transformed from a marshy village to one of the priciest parts of the country. As we go through the south side, I will shed light on place names, social history, and the area as it is today. And this month, the show will focus on the area of Cabinteely for an archaeology special. And returning to the show is the ever brilliant Camilla Peterson, who is perfect for this episode. Welcome back to the show, Camilla.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me back again.
Oh, anytime, anytime. Last time you were here, of course, it was Saggart, and yes, a lot of that was under the ground as well. So for our archaeology special, I couldn't think of anybody better. Thank you for returning, of course. And to remind everyone listening, Camilla hails from Denmark, but currently resides in Maynooth. Her focus of study is on Viking period mythology and narrative tradition, but an alumna of Maynooth University, her main research focus was on early Irish narrative and literary tradition in comparison to Old Norse narrative tradition and literary tropes of the supernatural, with special focus on shapeshifting. Her other areas of focus, though, which we will put to very good use today, are Old Irish linguistics and prehistoric and early medieval archaeology. You can read her work as she has been published on these topics, most recently in 2019 with Amsterdam University Press. And speaking of archaeology, this episode will be one of our archaeo specials. Usually when you're on yourself and usually when Trish is on, it's an archaeology heavy show. But we thought, because we reference in the show these excavations, I thought it'd be do it justice to come to the end of the season and do a real deep dive into archaeology. And I couldn't think of a better place than Cabinteely.
Good choice.
And neighbouring Carrick Mines and Loughlinstown, because not only has there been recent excavations, but there have been excavations over the decades in these areas. So as we go on, you'll realise also why I picked this area, because she's a Dane. So hint, I wonder what particular period you might be looking at. So to kick off then, the juxtaposition of industrial and residential development, Camilla.
Yes.
And built heritage. And this is kind of a vein that's going to be running through this episode. Developing industry, developing big residential areas in Dublin, but then hitting off and then coming into contact with the very rich history that's below the ground in these areas. And of course, when you come across that, that is then subject to subsequent excavation and then, of course, enveloped by heavy residential expansion. So what do you do after you find it? You still have to build the house.
Yeah.
You still have to build the Lewis. What happens to the archaeology after that, which I think is a good episode to expand on in this particular area. Now, Dunleary Rathdown County Council created a descriptive analysis of protected structures in Dublin and Wicklow, and this included heritage, monuments and place name origins in the area, which included Cabinteely, Carrick Mines and Loughlinstown, which I'm kind of referring to as a triangle, a kind of a little, if you look at it on a map, it's kind of like an archaeo triangle.
Bermuda Triangle of archaeology.
The Bermuda Triangle of just lost into like infrastructure and transport. But there is a statutory list of all known archaeological monuments in Dunleary Rathdown County Council, and it is contained in the current Dunleary Rathdown County Council development plan. So the 2010 to 2016 County Development Plan contains this list, which falls within their planning scheme area. Now, I'll be referring to zones and scheming areas and development areas, because once these development areas come into contact with history, it's interesting then to watch how these development zones then bounce off and interact with the rich cultural history of the area. For example, one of those monuments included is the Brennanstown Dolmen. Now, the Brennanstown Dolmen Tomb is one of the earliest upstanding monuments in the Cherrywood area. It's late Stone Age, Neolithic, and the dolmen lies in the Druid's Glen adjoining the Carrick Mines stream. It's located immediately outside the planning scheme area, which means then that this has potential for archaeology. It's within the kind of strategic development zone, but it's also then enveloped in heavy residential construction and development. It is a magnificent portal tomb. If you ever get a chance to go see, you have to ask permission to go up and have a look. It's characterised by a very, very large capstone. It was noted actually just there on the 21st of November back in 2021 by one Sean McCarthick, who was writing for the Irishmen on Sunday, that public access to one of the country's finest dolmens is now under threat
from the proposed sale of a NAMA controlled site in South Dublin. The lands off Brennan's Town Road in Cabinteely, County Dublin, which were once owned by developer Johnny Ronan, provide one of the main access routes to the relatively unknown and secluded Glen Druid Dolmen, a name it's also known, and it's the country's 10th largest dolmen tomb. It's believed to date to about 4000 BCE. Its capstone itself is estimated to weigh up to 50 tons.
Wow.
And walkers and local history enthusiasts actually went on and formed the Glen Druid Dolmen Public Forum on Facebook, or the GDPF, if you're looking for it. And they're calling for a condition to be attached to any sale of the property, which stipulates that the new owners guarantee public access to the site during and after any development. Now, the group has complained that the public right of access to the site is legally uncertain, and they were able to try and get OPW involved to try and figure out what was going on. The problem is that you have to cross private land to actually go and see the Dolmen Tomb, and you have to ask the owner's permission. Now, they haven't discouraged any visitors from going to see it, but that could get a bit sticky now with the sale literally going through as we speak. So the forum itself have noted that it's become increasingly difficult to actually visit the Dolmen, and the access point has an underpass that's near the closed Lewis stop at Brennan's Town Road, and that has recently been shut off by developers. So even if you went to go and try and find it now, it'd be quite hard too. So the Dolmen itself mostly located within the Cherrywood Strategic Development Zone, and because this extends to the Lewis Green Line, it has the capacity to hold up to 400 homes in a very well-desired location, which is between Foxrock and Cabinteely. So people are going to try and build homes here. However, the GDPF claims it is only the first lot that is relevant for access to the Dolmen. So sell the rest, it's okay. We just need access to the first lot that's being sold to go and see it. This also includes the former Glen Druid estate and the derelict Glen Druid House, a protected structure built by a Quaker businessman, John Barrington, in the early 19th century, and which we will mention later. So the problem now seems to be who actually is going to make the call as to where the public can go and see the 6,000-year-old tomb. So the people who own the land are saying, oh, that'll go to the person who buys the land. The person who buys the land will go, oh, that'll be with the OPW, because they're the ones who have ownership over, or, you know, guardianship over this tomb. Once we know, we'll let you know, but it's actually happening right now. But as we mentioned at the very, very start, this kind of triangle is no stranger to extensive archaeology, isn't it not?
No, there is definitely a lot of archaeology in the area. And as you already mentioned, excavations has been taking place in this whole area for years, for decades at this point. So all the way back in 1957, a lintel grave with an inhumation was found at Eastmount, or Mount Offaly, at Loughlinstown. And this was a kist burial, so kind of like you would have a coffin now, but it's made out of stone. And it was lined west to east. Part of the kist had unfortunately collapsed onto the remains that had disturbed the grave. But it was determined that it was a male, approximately about 25 years of age at the time of death. So fairly young person for our standard. The area where it was found was also known as Moatfield, or Raheen, meaning little wrath. So, of course, indicating some form of presence of a ring fort or a wrath. And it was later given the nickname Graves Moat. Now, when houses were being built during the 1930s, human bones had been found throughout, and they were then reinterred. So we don't really have any archaeological reports about them, but a lot of the people who live in the area were well aware that this had actually happened back then. In 1991, a single human skeleton burial was found as well, but this time at the root ball of a fallen tree. The burial was extended, so again, full human, oriented east-west, with the head at the west and the arms crossed over the pelvis. So it's looking very much almost Christian. You know, or at least early Christian. There was also worked antler burr found nearby, and the burial was very close to another long stone kist. So we're kind of indicating a cemetery.
Yeah.
Of a very early medieval origin. The remains there were also male, with the upper half of the body actually still incorporated into the roots of the tree. Ooh. Yes. So clearly, tree came later.
Tree did come later.
Yeah. But this is often how we find these things. It's by pure chance. Mm-hmm. There were two additional probable burials discovered, but because they were so incorporated as well into the roots of other trees, it was just simply impossible to excavate without fully disturbing, and you wouldn't get a clear answer. Mm. Osteoarchaeology showed that this particular male lodged in a tree was between 26 and 45 at the time of death. He was about 176 centimetres tall, so actually quite tall. Mm. And he had an abnormality in his right shoulder. So this indicates some form of repetitive use. Mm. Kind of like today would say factory work, but very hard physical labor, day out, day in. And there's also a possible crush fracture on the vertebrae. And there is some slight degeneration on some of the joints on the vertebral column, again, supporting this whole idea of hard physical labor. And this, of course, all indicates this was a man who performed all this hard physical labor on a daily basis, and he's simply worn down. That's why they would die early, because they just, if you're not working, you're not going to eat. In 1998, excavations associated then with the construction of the motorway revealed 1,553 burials dating to the 5th to the 12th centuries. So this is where the name Graves Moat suits the area pretty well.
Yeah.
Now, there's also a lot of evidence from the Bronze Age in South Dublin. We find it everywhere, scattered, little settlements, pits, the likes of that. But there's not a whole much from the period following it, the Iron Age, which is odd because you would assume a continuation. But during the construction of the M50, excavations uncovered evidence spanning the Neolithic, so 4000 before Christ, up to and including the Iron Age, so up to 400 AD. So 4,400 years worth of history just in the M50. At Carrickmines Great, one of only five known possible Iron Age settlements were found. The excavation uncovered post holes indicating a house, possibly similar in shape to what we would say is a wigwam. Mm. It's kind of pointed tent shape. They also found an iron smelting furnace, which are very rare. Very few of them have been found in Ireland, at least. And a cremation burial. Now, the burial was in a pit with charcoal, and that's how it's very easy to date. And within this charcoal, we found a cremated right humerus, so the upper arm bone, so a pretty big piece of bone. Now, carbon-14 dating gave a date for the bone around 340 to 540 AD. So it is a broad period, but it's still within the late Iron Age. Mm. They also found unburned cattle bones, and these had little cut marks on it, indicating some kind of butchery, and also small pieces of flints. And it has been suggested that this was part of a ceremony which followed the interment of the deceased human. Now, when we look at some of the other kist burials that we talked about as well, this is a much more old school way of burying your dead, even in the Iron Age, because at this point we're seeing more a leaning towards an early Christian type of burial. No burial goods, inhumations, full bodies, not cremation. So it is a bit odd. Now, the structures that were found on the site as well could be evidence of a settlement, but it is so scarce. There's really only three structures found, and they've been quite disturbed. So we can't gather a whole lot of information from it. But usually at this point, if you have something that looks like a house, it's a house.
And I think that what you said there, especially with the Iron Age, the likes of Colin O'Driscoll, who did great work on the Iron Age and Carrickmines Great, he notes that the Carrickmines Great can be considered the most convincing example yet found of an Irish Iron Age domestic settlement.
Yeah.
Very few found in Ireland, the fact that we have one right in the middle of Carrickmines. The activity there, as you mentioned, involved the construction of the first half of a kind of this Iron Age small homestead. And then, of course, you have this kind of open, undefended, probably modest post-built circular house there, which is your wigwam, as you said, where people would convene for metalworking and the cultivation of cereals. So the environs that were populated then had oak, ash, alder, hazelwood, apple trees, and then they also would have had ivy and sloe and grasses present, and they could find out what was growing in the area from this excavation. Also, the domestic activity was succeeded at the end of the Iron Age by a waterhole, and then a rare example, as you said, of what we would call post-400 AD human cremation, which, of course, back in 2007 then, when this is written, it's impossible to know then or to form an opinion as if the Carrickmines Great was an isolated Iron Age settlement, which is even more exciting how unique it would have been. Or were they even interacting with a wider economic and social setting? We just don't know.
But I think it's also very important to understand when we talk about the Iron Age and settlements, we're not talking about 60, 70, 80, 90 houses. We're talking one or two.
Yeah.
It's more of a homestead than an actual settlement. And that's why they're so hard to find, because they're scattered all around. Usually you can find them near water and the likes of that, because, of course, that's a natural resource. But it's not like with a Viking settlement where there's going to be loads of houses. it is a homestead more so than settlement. But to follow on from all of our excavation talk here, because we're really getting into it, during the construction of the Lewis B1, Sandyford to Cherrywood, that extension there, archaeological excavations were conducted along that route as well as part of the planning. And this is how most of the impressive archaeology is actually found. It is these big builds, mm-hmm. it is big constructions, because basically if we don't have a reason to dig, they don't. Now, the excavations revealed three phases. So prehistoric, 18th and 19th century agricultural activity, and 18th and 19th century military camp activity. Now, only 60 meters to the east is the well-known Loughlinstown camp, and Tolley Church lies approximately 200 meters then to the west. Two possible prehistoric structures were found. One was a series of stake holes in a pit with prehistoric fill, and the second was a large pit with flints, as well as an in-situ burning activity. So we know it was kind of flint making, the likes of that. Now, evidence from the military camp included post holes for potential tent structures, tokens, buttons, cap badges, musket balls, and those are the little paraphernalia that you kind of would drop.
Mm-hmm.
As the amount of artifacts were quite small, this may actually just been an outlying camp from the main camp that was only 60 meters away and not part of the center itself. And at St. Bridget's National School in Cabinteely, they actually found two Bronze Age axes during gardening in 2011. Now, the site itself is the former demesne of Cabinteely House, or Clare Hall as it was known as well. And the axes were located close together, suggesting a hoard, but nothing else was found. Excavations also revealed evidence of a probable Bronze Age settlement or habitation activity, homestead, essentially. And then in 2016, there was excavations at Tolley Park that revealed evidence from the military camp as well. And this was with a specific Kildare militia button that was found during metal detection. So we know who was where and when. And the investigation there also identified four new areas of archaeological significance, two of these relating to the military camp. So we are seeing a lot of early military activity out in Loughlinstown, which we will talk about more later.
Yes, and on that note, we are going to get back down to prehistoric Loughlinstown, Cabinteely Carrick Mines just after the break.
This is Dublin South FM.
So welcome back to Dublin's Historic South. I'm still here and so is the lovely Camilla.
I am indeed.
Thank you. And so just before the break, we were getting really stuck into the major excavations, but there's just been so many in this little triangle, as I'm coining it, of these three areas. We're focusing kind of mainly on Cabinteely only because it overlaps a lot with the areas around Brennanstown and Loughlinstown. And we mentioned just there before the break, the extension of the Lewis. And that's probably the most recent really big upend to that area, that and of course the M50. So speaking of the Lewis extension, that was due to the railway order of 2006, and that was to extend Sandyford's Green Line to Cherrywood. And as noted by the TIIWE, which is the Transport Infrastructure Ireland, it really upended that area from Sandyford out towards Cherrywood and on into Bride's Glen, which I know that you'll be getting to a little bit later, Camilla. But what it has done is create a route that links Sandyford, then to Ballyogan, to Carrick Mines, to Loughonstown. And from Loughonstown, you're sure you're only 20 minutes away then from Cabinteely. And then on to Cherrywood and, of course, to Bride's Glen. But also, there is the M50 that runs almost pretty much alongside it. Actually, there is another megalithic tomb at Loughonstown, which is also a national monument. And it's located approximately to the intersection of Wyattville Link Road and the M50. So if anyone's driven towards Ballybrack, they'll know exactly where this is. But what was there was a wedge tomb, which dated to the late Neolithic, to the beginning of the Bronze Age. So roughly 2,500 to 500 BC. So we're talking in and around 3,000-4,000 year old monument. And this cairn was indicated in the field on the early editions of the Ordnance Survey map, but then was subsequently removed by quarrying. To hear even stories of that of other megalithic tombs not making it, some did though, of course, as you know.
Yeah, because the South Dublin Mountains are littered with megalithic tombs. You just need to know where to find them. And there's also loads of other monuments up there from the prehistoric period. Now we have portal tombs in Brennanstown, Kiltearnan, Rathfarnham and Ballybrack. There are passage tombs in Tibratton, Ferrycastle, Montpellier, Sagard Hill. And there are wedge tombs at Ballyedmanduff, which we mentioned in the Dublin Mountains episode.
Mm-hmm.
Enniscill Mhaigh, just to name a few. These are not all of them. This is just a few of them. All of these monuments in the Dublin Mountains, they are part of a wider network of prehistoric grave monuments, which didn't just serve as graves. These were identifiers in terms of who are you? This mm-hmm. is my identity. This is who we are. And they're often found on slopes or on flat fields. And they would have been visible from everywhere. Walking up towards the Dublin Mountains, you would have been able to see them. You might not now, but nature changes, of course, over 4,000 years. And the bigger they were, the more the community that built them could show off. You know, when you see a small passage tomb, you go, oh yeah, you know, there's a nice little community there. And then you go out to Brúna Boyne and go, oh dear Lord.
They're the big ones.
They're the big ones. These people out here were very, very, very wealthy, especially when you consider how small the grave chambers in those passage tombs actually are.
Yeah.
So they were very much a way of showing who we are, we're here, but also we're rich.
Yeah, and I think that's what's interesting is that you have this continuous use of the landscape and these, as you said, identity markers on the landscape, which are now either getting completely eroded away, but even up until about 10 years ago, a lot of that between Cherrywood, Bride's Glen, Lochinstown, Cavantini, that was all countryside. It was open parkland and big open spaces, and it's changed so much. But I actually am glad that you mentioned wealth there, because as we finally move on into the medieval period, just early medieval, yes, but we're getting there. What is apparent is that between Cabinteely, Carrickmines and Loughlinstown, the land was used for a very long time and will later be held by big families, descendants of which exist right up into the last century. And though prehistory is a big draw for archaeologists, so is the reason why these areas garner their place names. Usually we kick off the episode's etymology, but in this case, it makes a lot more sense as we move into the medieval period to pepper the etymology through the episode, as you'll notice.
If you look at the place names in the area, you have three very similar sounding place names, or at least when you look at them writing. In mm-hmm. writing, you have Loughlinstown and Lochanstown, which is two different writings depending on where you go. Now, Lochanstown and the other spelling, Lochanstown, they're essentially the same in Irish.
Mm-hmm.
They're both Balia and Lochan. Balia, of course, is the Irish word for town or homestead. And Lochan, I would argue, is the Irish word loch, lake, with the diminutive on. So little lake. So the homestead or town of the little lake. And there is actually a little lake in the area.
Mm.
Now, when, of course, these names become anglicized after the invasion in 1169, they don't write them the way they're necessarily meant to. Mm-hmm. They're writing what they hear.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably also why you have often a lot of different spellings for the same place, because it might be different people writing down at different periods, and then the documents get saved, but it depends on which document you get a hold on. It's just different spellings. And I think it is the town of the little lake, although it has been argued to have something to do with the Vikings, but we're getting to that later. Now, Loughlin's town is a little different, with his Irish name being Balia I Lochnan. Balia, again, is the Irish for town or homestead. E is a very typical part of Irish surnames, as many of you may know, meaning grandson of. And you have it in all O surnames, O'Neill, O'Brien, a whole lot. Now, the Lochnan is slightly problematic. Now, due to the E, we know it's a surname of some sort. And Lochnan has been argued to be derived from Lochlan, which is primarily found in Scotland. But this is in turn then argued to be derived from the Gaelic word for Norway, Lochlan or Lochlana, and was used in the annals to describe the invading forces of the Norsemen. Now, where the term Lochlan originated, it's really hard to say specifically. It's not something that the Norsemen called themselves.
Mm.
And there's nowhere in Scandinavia that's called Lochlan.
Yeah.
That's not where we're getting it from. It can be argued, however, that the E Lochlan does not refer to a first-generation Norseman, but rather a Hiberno-Norse, if at all to a specific person. And that is, of course, due to the E.
Yeah.
This is not a name commonly found in the annals as a personal name used by the Norsemen themselves who settled in Ireland, but could just be a very literal use of a surname to identify, as was common at the time, taking on the Irish tradition of the E rather than a son or dottir, which would have been used in the Scandinavian homelands and can still be found in surnames today ending in son in English-speaking countries. The whole E Lochnan, we don't know whether Lochnan was a Lochlan, a Norseman. or whether it was someone who decided to take on the mantle of Lochnan, or whether that's actually just an Irish name that got lost over the years, we don't know. But the theories are many. But considering that we know that there were Vikings in the area, it is probable.
Yeah, I think that's what people are kind of, well, some theorists are hedging it on, the fact that there were Vikings in the area, which I know you're going to be getting to. And other place names that we will be essentially dotting throughout the show. But whilst at Lochan's town and to Lachlan's town, both different areas, by the way, most of this kind of open countryside, which is now very much getting developed, along with Brennan's town, is part of Cabin Tealy. And Cabin Tealy in Irish is Cabán Síle, which means Sheila's cabin or Cabán Síle. But why? So from 1687, I'll tell you.
Yes,
so,
please, do.
From 1687 to 1703, it was actually spelled like Cabán Síle, which is, I'm not going to call out all the words, but very interestingly spelled. But the cabin is cause for confusion. There are theories that it may be a hut, cabin, tavern-like pub structure, or that it was an area made of temporary accommodation, which is what I'm kind of leaning towards. Like huts made of dried mud, which is what you'd find as like temporary accommodations. Yeah. And in Twiss's tour of Ireland in 1776, he notes that there is these cabin-like structures around now where Cabán Tealy, Cabán Síle is. And when the Lochan's town camp were built, this kind of lends more credence, because what you'll find is in military camps is this kind of temporary accommodation, tent-like, gazebo-like, early prefab-like temporary structures, obviously a bit more rudimentary built originally, but you have this kind of temporary accommodation for people to only stay there for a couple of nights and then move on. That's why we were getting the cabins, and men would go cabining, they would cabin for a while and then they'd go off either to go join as mercenaries or whatever. However, at one stage, according to Loganam.ie, Cabán Tealy is simply referred to as the lands of Cornel's Court. Now, Cornel's Court is a much older name for the area, and nearby Cornel's Court, and the Duns there is probably what everybody knows, was actually referred to by Allen's Register in 1534 as such, as Cornel's Court, two separate words. But before that, it was Corner's Court, or Corner's Town. And interestingly, that's how my brother pronounced it for years. He couldn't say Cornel's Court, he said Corner's Court. So maybe he was right all along.
He knew.
And so from about 1326 onwards, it was Corner's Town or Corner's Court. And again, look, Annam.ie, when you're sifting through all those scan records and that sprawly writing from a fella from about 60 years ago, it suggests that it was a personal name. So Corner was a person, and then it either became or was mispronounced or written down wrong as Cornell, or the original name was Cornell and was mispronounced as Corner. But there was a Wilhelmus Cornell recorded still living in the area in around the mid-18th century. And then I went on to An Dúchas, that fantastic folklore collection.
We love An Dúchas.
We love Dúchas. Yes. From 1937 to 1938. And they note, a child was writing in their diary, that a man called Mr. Cornell built a castle, hence the name, Cornell's Court. And at the north end of the village, which is now called Clonkeen, still is a school there now, that was owned by a Miss Byrne of Cabán Tealy House. So we'll be getting to the Byrnes, O'Byrnes, I should say, and Cabán Tealy's a little bit later, but the kid just said Miss Byrne. Now, the rest of Cabán Tealy then is mainly parkland, with Cabán Tealy and Kilgobbet Park. It borders Ballybrack, Carrick Mines, Cherrywood, Cornell's Court, Dean's Grange, Fox Rock, Johnstown, Killiney, and indeed Lachlanstown. That's a lot of areas to border. Yeah. So Cabán Tealy is our main focus on the episode because it overlaps with a lot of those smaller areas as you're going around what we've created, this little triangle. But one of those neighbouring little areas that I mentioned there was indeed Cherrywood.
Yes. And it's funny when we think of Ireland after the Viking invasion, or should I say subsequent settlement, here in Ireland, we tend to think of Dublin, Waterford and Wexford, because these are the urban Viking settlements of the 9th and 11th centuries. These are where we have the most evidence. This is the most preserved evidence, and also where we have most of the annals and the written history from.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for Dublin, if you just look at the excavations there at Fishamble Street, the remains of the Viking settlement there, part of the wall underneath Dublin Castle, and then also under the civic offices, there is a lot just there.
Yeah.
Now, we also tend to use the term Viking settlement, which really isn't appropriate as a name to kind of label the inhabitants within. It makes it sound as if it was only Vikings who lived in Dublin. And because these are urban areas, we would see a lot of people mixing.
Yeah.
And especially by the 9th century, this is the case. We see both Irish and Scandinavians essentially living in the same areas. So we shall use the very apt term of Hiberno Norse, which was defined quite well by the late John Bradley back in 1988. Now, the term itself really kind of encapsulates this integrated group of settlers who at this stage had developed, to some extent, a shared identity with the locals, while still also maintaining some elements of their own culture. So it's really a melting pot.
Yeah.
But besides the urban Hiberno Norse settlements, we also have a few rural settlements in the 9th to 12th centuries. Due to often drier grounds in those areas and continued agricultural practices, very little of the rural settlement survives.
Yeah.
And at the moment, there is less than a handful of positively identified rural Hiberno Norse settlements in Ireland. These rural settlements are usually identified by a mixture of archaeological evidence, place names, and a proximity to historical events that we know happened based on the annals. So Leixlip, for example, which we mentioned back in season one, is identified as a Hiberno Norse settlement based on a place name. Leixlip literally means Loxlapa, but there's no definitive archaeological evidence there.
Yeah.
You know, so in terms of the historical events, this evidence is also very scarce because as annals, for example, they won't really focus on the, you know, the hinterland. They're focusing on the larger urban settlements and the power centres that they are. Although archaeological evidence for rural Hiberno Norse settlement is rare, excavations at Cherrywood did reveal evidence of a potential rural settlement. There were three buildings that were discovered first in 1999. The first structure was identified as a possible longhouse. Now, this is unusual. I'll get back to that in a minute. Structure 2 was a possible type 1 house that we also find in Dublin. And structure 3 was a rectangular building. There was also a stone cobbling between structures 2 and 3. So this is kind of, you know, creating a little walkway.
Mm.
Not get your feet wet. Now, longhouses, they were these great halls that we find back in Scandinavia. Some of them are absolutely massive. You find them across Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Iceland. These are very great halls. This is where your chiefs, this is where your power centers are. This is where most of the trade goes from. And this is really to show wealth, power. Type 1 house, again, is the most common one we see in Dublin. And it has also been argued to stem from an architectural concept, again, established in Scandinavia, specifically Kaupang in Norway. Mm-hmm. This is the best preserved example we have at the moment. And that predates the Dublin settlement with almost 100 years. These type 1 houses, they do look like miniature longhouses, the structure of them, with a fireplace in the middle, entrance in one, and then you sleep on the sides of them, or you have seating on the sides of the houses. But it can't be defined for sure. You can't really know for sure. The Dublin versions as well have been argued to be their own kind of house, their own kind of version of this longhouse as the ones that were found in Kaupanga. But that's because they're built different. But you also have to remember, it's a very different climate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a lot more open up there. Winters are harsher.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, you're going to use slightly different building materials. But the actual foundations look very, very similar. The presence of a longhouse and the two other structures really does suggest to me that this was quite a wealthy family, or at least wanting to be a wealthy, important family. And the discovery as well of the whalebone plaque, or part of it, one should say, really supports this. Now, the whalebone itself is not something that was traded regularly in Ireland at the time because it's very hard to come by. It's very hard to forming it and shaping it. It's a long process. The piece itself measures around 11 centimeters and is shaped like a horse's head in profile and is leaning in towards the middle of what would have been a full plaque. Now, there would have been a mirrored horse head on the other side, and the plaque is very similar to one found in the boat burial at Scar in the Orkneys. John O'Neill has also argued that the presence of this plaque indicated the presence of women, and thereby domestic work, because these have usually been found as grave goods in wealthy 9th century female Norse burials in Norway and southern Scotland. He also notes that the Hiberno Norse settlement was located in an Iron Age enclosure. So we're reusing an older site again. And this Iron Age enclosure actually contained cremated human remains. and it was then also reused in the 5th to 8th centuries as a cemetery with 38 inhumations. So this site has been used twice as a burial site, and along comes the Vikings and go, this is a great spot for living.
I want to put my house here.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's interesting as well, that whalebone plaque, I mean, I remember, because that's actually in the National Museum of Ireland archaeology up in Vikings in Ireland, you can see. And what they've done beautifully is they've created what the rest of the plaque would have looked like. So the original is slotted in and they've remade the outside based off that one that you said was found in the Orkney. So please go and see it if you haven't. It's upstairs in the Archaeology Museum. So I'm glad that you did mention the Vikings there, Camilla. Thank you very much for that. But also because it is interesting that they were in Cherrywood, literally on the other end of the Lewis line from where we are, just very near Sandyford. But Tully Church, I wanted to mention very briefly, still while we're, I'm going to bring us back into Cabin Teely a bit, and I wanted to mention very briefly, still while we're, I'm going to bring us back into Cabin Teely a bit. But Tully Church, and very interestingly, Christian Corlett, who's done great work around this area, and so has Emer Condit back in 2013, wrote for Archaeology Ireland about Tully Church, which is actually in the townland of Lahonstown near Cabin Teely. But much like is what you find with the case of Cabin Teely, it overlaps a lot with these areas. So you hear that it's the Cabin Teely Tully Church, or it's the Lahonstown Tully Church. Like the way you'd have the Brennanstown tomb, but it's also the Glen Druid tomb. So it kind of just, I don't know if it depends which side of it you're living on, but what's interesting is that where Tully Church is located, it's right between the foothills of the Dublin Mountains and the Irish Sea. To the east, you have this pre-Norman church, which later additions dated to the 13th century, and you've got two high crosses and three grave slabs, which were actually known as the Rathdown grave slabs, which I know you'll be getting onto. And of course, the ancient name of Tully Church was Tulochne Epskop, which is the Hill of the Bishops. And it was the ancient kingdom of the Ibrian Cúlann, which is actually mentioned in the early 9th century martyrology of Angus. And then later the Dáil Mesam Corrib ruled this area during the 5th and the 6th century. But what's an exception with Tully Church in South Dublin is that it is linked to St. Bridget. What's also interesting is Angus refers to Cabin Teely as a place beside Kildare. So I thought it'd be, because you live in Maynooth, obviously, I thought it'd be funny to throw that in. Dublin's not really a thing at this stage. It's a place beside Kildare, which I find fascinating. So the actual area, the actual Tully Church itself, was actually, the site was founded in the 8th century when Éirinn Cúlann came under the influence of the Idunglenga, which are, of course, linked to Kildare. But as I mentioned there, Camilla, the Rathdown grave slabs, there were three of them found at Tully Church.
Yeah, the Rathdown grave slabs are named after the former barony of Rathdown, not the current specific area of Rathdown. And the slabs are decorated and have been attributed to the Scandinavians in the area, and they were erected between the 9th and the 12th centuries. They're found at the early church sites. Christian Corlett, as you already mentioned, has done some great works on these specific slabs, such as his contribution Rathdown Slabs Revisited in the volume Vikings in Ireland and Beyond, which was edited by Howard B. Clarke and Ruth Johnson.
Mm-hmm. I've read it.
It's really good. Mm-hmm. The main motifs on the slabs are cup marks, concentric circles, linear bands, herringbone patterns, arcs and crosses. The decorations covered the entire stone, which separates them from similar pre-Anglo-Norman grave slabs in Ireland. The concentric circles with the cup marks are the most typical motif used, and they usually consist of two or three circles around one cup mark. These Rathdown slabs represent recumbent or horizontal grave markers in a Christian tradition and are large enough to have covered an entire extended grave. Now, Christian Corlett argues that it's possible that these were only being made over a 50-year period due to lack of development in design, and the overall appearance suggests a date of the 11th to mid-12th century. Although some motifs do suggest an earlier date. Now, a great question that was raised from all this research on the slabs is, if these were made by people of Norse identity, why are they not found in other areas where the Norse settled? Why is it only here? The repeated use of selected motifs implies that they had a symbolic meaning. The cup and ring motifs are somewhat reminiscent of the early round Viking shields, which were replaced with kite-shaped shields well before the 12th century, but the round shields could still have been in use in Ireland after the 12th century. In terms of archaeological evidence, very little of a shield would survive due to the wood deteriorating quickly, and we would only really find metal rings and metal bosses, or maybe a leather strap here or there. Now, looking at the written evidence, Giraldus Cambrensis, whom we mentioned before, mentions in the Expugnatio Hibernica that during a Viking attack in Dublin in 1171, they carried round shields. Now, this may be a true account, but Cabrensis has also been argued to be not fully reliable as a source.
Oh, we've definitely mentioned it before.
Yes. as there are elements in his text that are just propaganda against the Irish. However, in terms of his description of these particular shields, it may be a correct account. We don't know. Now, Colette argues that the decorations are interpretations of decorated shields and what would become heraldry as we know it today, and they may have represented these Viking shields. In terms of the reasons why these were made as a way of conveying identity, we know there was strong links between the area of the former barony of Rathdown and Wales in earlier centuries, and the Hiberno-Norse of Dublin maintained a very strong tie with Wales during the 11th and 12th centuries. Now, by the 12th century, there appears to have been an active settlement of exiled Welsh in the Dublin hinterlands. It has been argued that this is evident in the possible Irish place names for Brennan's Town, Ballion Brannach, which is Town of the Welsh, Walsh and Howell families, all of Welsh origin, settled in the parish of Tully, Kilgobbin, which in the 12th century was listed as Chach Brannach or Chach na Brannach, as well as Tibrodon, which was Chachnabranach. So they're basically all saying the town of the Welsh.
Yeah.
Basically, we don't exactly know who made these slabs or when, just that it was probably between the 9th and 12th centuries, with evidence pointing towards the mid to late 11th to the mid 12th century. And we don't know the exact purpose of the decorations of the slabs, but we know that they were some kind of specific grave tradition in this particular area.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting because we mentioned it as well in Rathmichael when we were on the Shankill episode. And now, thankfully, they've been put onto the wall so you can go and see them. And they are fascinating to go and see. And you can see that lovely herringbone, that concentric circle design up close. And as you said, very strong Norse link there. But then you have these big Hiberno-Norse settlements or a potential big rural settlement right in the middle of this triangle, as we're calling it. Before the Anglo-Norman arrival, the church at Tully then and these surrounding lands were granted to Dublin's Holy Trinity Church, or Christ Church, by Sitric MacTurgle, Hiberno-Norse, a ruling Viking family in Dublin. So again, you've got Vikings now who've become Christianised, who've converted to Christianity. They are well settled. There is Hiberno-Norse within the area. So what's becoming apparent as we're going through Cabinteely, Carrick Mines, Loughlinstown, but always has its own like unique little way of living in the area as well.
Yeah, it's almost like a city within a city.
Like a little microcosm.
Yeah.
But not necessarily, we don't know if they're actually contacting a wider economic setting. And we'll be getting a bit more to that kind of isolation settlement or isolated residence a little bit later on as well. But sometime later, Archbishop Lorcan Ní Hualgh, or Lorcan O'Toole, granted various lands in South Dublin to the Augustinian Priory of the Holy Trinity in Dublin. The Priory of the Holy Trinity then held a grange farm at nearby Clonkeen, or what's now modern day Killow the Grange, because that side of Cornell's Court, you're very close to, you're kind of heading towards Sally Noggin, Killiney, Dunleary, you're heading down that end, which is what Cabinteely hits off on the other side. The lands of Tully then formed an extension of these Grange lands, so between Tully Church and Cabinteely all the way down towards Killow the Grange, but it seems likely that they were leased to the Archbold family throughout this period. Less than 400 metres then to the southwest of Tully Church, and also in the townland of Loughonstown, is a tower house associated with the Archbold family. The church and graveyard at Tully were also intimately linked with the Walsh family, again with Welsh background as you said, at neighbouring Carrick Mines, and there is evidence that Tully was the ancestral burial place of the Walshes well into the 18th century. By 1630, the church is in ruins, and a one Simon Swain is the curate. And the Down survey map now about 1657 shows that Tully is its own parish, which included the modern day townlands of Leopardstown, Carrick Mines, Brennanstown, Loughonstown and Cherrywood, which is today the parish of Killiney. So likely to have pre-Norman roots, this shows the extent of Tully parish throughout the medieval period. Would have had huge sway back in early medieval South Dublin at the very least. To make this actual church, they would have had locally sourced granite, and the original stone church then dates to about 1100. The south window is very like the east window at the Kill of the Grange site, which dates to 1200s. That's why you have additions then to the chancel when it was built, which is why they call it a 13th century stone church on site. Now, what's interesting is that the chancel is actually larger than the nave. Usually it's the nave and the chancel's based off of it, and the chancel will have like a, will use the nave roof and they'd mirror it and they'd create their own chancel at a reduced scale. In this case, it's the other way around. So again, it's a bit of a curious sight. Also, despite links of the Walsh and Archibald families during the late medieval period, there are no signs of any significant investment into the church after the 13th century and in terms of the fabric of the church itself. So it's kind of almost abandoned really after the 13th century. So those rat down slabs that were found at Tully Church were actually removed and put into safekeeping by the OPW, or Office of Public Works. And there's a cross that actually stands in a field to the northwest of the church. It does not appear to be in situ. So that was actually shifted, and I'll be getting to that a little bit later. But the base consists a large stone boulder, and on the top surface of the base is a lightly incised cross, 2.32 metres high, with one arm missing. You can still go see it today. It has quite a withered face, but the figure on the side is carved in relief. It has a very long beard, and the facial features have worn away, but the hands look like it's holding a crozier. What's also interesting is that there's no hat, there's no mitre. It's a bare-headed figure. So, the figure on the cross, if it's before 1161, means it's Bishop Gren, who was then succeeded by Lorcan O'Toole. So if it's post 1161, it's more than likely him, because he would have been established as a monk bishop, a monk archbishop of Dublin, and that explains why he's bareheaded, not having a big elaborate mitre, but having no headpiece on at all. So possibly it's Lorcan O'Toole even on that high cross. The church is then situated towards the eastern end of this kind of oval-like enclosure. Along the west, a road arcs around the graveyard and is flanked by a granite wall. And also present along the north of this road and the wall that's there may have been built at the time because of the infamous military camps that stood just below the church in the late 18th century. I know you'll be getting to that later, yep. Camilla. But these camps had reviews and manoeuvres in place that consisted of an attack on a company which would defend the ruins of Tully Church and Graveyard. So they actually had a manoeuvre at the military camp in case anybody attacked Tully Church and Graveyard, they'd be able to go and defend it. So it was even encompassed then later into this military camp, which is rather fascinating.
I mentioned the military camp earlier. And just as you said there, the Lahanstown, or Loughlinstown, or Cabin Teely, dates to the 18th century and has the largest zone of archaeological potential within the planning scheme, according to Dunleary Rathdown County Council. Now, this camp dates to the time when there was a significant military threat of a Napoleonic invasion of Ireland, and it was capable of holding approximately 4,000 men. The extent of the camp has always proved difficult to define on the ground. And to date, the only elements of the camp that have been identified have all been subsurface remains. It is recognized that the extent of the military camp extends beyond the zone of archaeological potential, however, so it's probably bigger than we think it is. The camp appears to have extended along two ridges that run northwest-southeast between Loughlinstown River, Lahanstown Lane, and Tully Church. Associated activities of the camp probably use structures and topographic features in the area, such as Tully Church and Lahanstown Castle. There was an earlier camp established in 1690, centred on Gun and Drum Hill, to the north of Tully Church. Lahanstown Lane may be part of a military road associated with the camp. And it has also been hypothesized that the straight stretch of Lahanstown Lane to the north of the camp was a double bank and ditch used for military maneuvers. This is also where you get Castle Street from, given to the street which links Lahanstown Castle in Lahanstown Park to Carrigmines Castle. Also, Mercer's Road, the Mercer family, tenants of Brandonstown, held the lands at Lahanstown in the 18th century. The big grave slab on the floor of Tully Church was put there by Richard Mercer in the 1790s, and it records his daughter's death and leaves room for the rest of the family, but he ran into financial difficulties and left to live in Scotland. The Mercer's lands were chosen as the location of the large military camp, Lahanstown Camp, following his departure. And other family names include Bolton, the owner of the land at Lahanstown and Brennanstown was Lyndon Bolton. The family was involved in the area for a significant period, and Green, the family that farmed the Lahanstown area in the 19th century and early 20th century. So you mentioned the cross in Lahanstown Lane earlier there, and that was re-sited then in 1897 on that high stone plinth. And then a plaque on its plinth records, inscribed by his friends to the memory of James Green, who saved this Celtic cross.
Oh, so he's the one who moved it then.
He is the one who moved
it. Out of the way or something.
Moved it to safety.
But that's interesting that you mentioned those families who played a big part in cultivating and developing this area, because for a long time it wouldn't have been extensively developed. We'll be getting to a few more of those big family names just after the break.
Broadcasting from the Dundrum Town Centre, this is Dublin South FM.
Welcome back to Dublin Historic South. I'm still here and so is Camilla. So just before the break, we were talking about big families who lived around the area, and we briefly mentioned the Walshes earlier. A great source, if you're interested, is The English Marcher Lineages in South Dublin in the Middle Ages by Christopher Magan in 2004. He did great work. And what he noted was that Gaelic hostility stunted the southward expansion of these big family names. And these families would have been from the original Norman conquest, so 12th century. Into South Dublin, and they were militarizing themselves over the centuries. So what happens then is these big families are obviously growing, and where are they going to go? And they kind of become isolated until Tudor influence, so 16th century big guns, come along and really stem these Gaelic raids in order to restore order to what they refer to as the Dublin Marches. So the Dublin Marches were areas of land on the border between these two territories. The Howells, as you mentioned there, Camilla, who have these Welsh lineage, they were very prominent until the first half of the 14th century, the head of which would have been Maurice Howell. He was the foremost marcher in South Dublin after Hugh Lawless. We mentioned the Lawless family a lot in the Shinekill episode. The Howell lands were not concentrated, but were scattered throughout the district. So Maurice held King's lands in Bray, from 1331 to 32, Ballyhawley, Ballyhammond, and Ballyteer, which we now know as Ballinteer. But he also owned several large tracts of lands at Carrickmines and Brennanstown from the Priory of the Holy Trinity in 1334. Howell apprehended several Irish felons for the Crown. So what they were doing were acting as this line of military defence up against the Dublin Mountains. Actually, in 1325, there was even an incident where one of the Lawlesses got Manus O'Byrne free of Dublin Castle, so some Lawlesses would be let go from their prison up in the mountains, so kind of swapping people out to
prisoner
get...
Prisoner exchange.
Prisoner exchange, exactly. Yeah. Walsh has emerged as a new force in the march, but they may have settled even before the initial conquest, because Walsh's town relates to anyone with Welsh ancestry, and it really only became a political and military presence in South Dublin in the march in the 15th century. So they were quite a small family for the first few centuries they were there. But everything changes in 1406 when John and David Walsh of Carrickmines grant Henry FitzAdam Walsh all of their lands in Carrickmines, Ballyroe and Aneddin in what is called a tail mail. And what a tail mail is an entailed interest under which only male descendants of the original tenant in tail can succeed to the land. If the male line dies out, the land goes to the person next entitled in remainder or in reversion, which means that if they were worried about not having enough men in the family or not having an heir, it would go to the tail male, and that's how the lands would survive. What this meant though for Henry is that he actually got a lot of these smaller lands and got himself a nice big chunk. And for really good service at the crown, Henry was also granted Thorn Castle. Now Walsh became a lineage head in Dublin Marches, and it probably ended up in their hands after the extinction of the Howells. But the Walshes were now living very close to the Lawlesses. But the Walsh of Carrickmines came out on top, despite in 1456 being accused, which he failed to turn up and surrender at Dublin Castle, to numerous accounts of extortion, oppression, robberies, treasons and felonies. So as Henry Walsh has been accused of all this stuff, you're kind of questioning why.
Yeah.
Well, these men are still needed. The Walshes are still needed. They're employed for military use anyway by the Crown, who would have been working via Dublin Castle. But what you also find in the 15th century are ideas of segregation. what's happening and what you mentioned as well, Camilla, earlier on, it's not just these English lineages, families living in this area. You've had people who were Native Irish living right alongside them for centuries and intermingling and intermarrying and living up next to each other. And even though you kind of create these like pure bloodlines what they're trying to introduce via Dublin Castle in the 15th century, that's not necessarily the case. And so with the Irish intermingling with these marchers and living in the same territories, by the 16th century, what you have then is these men being accused of all sorts. The Harolds, who were closer to the city centre, were being accused of this, of going off and fraternising with the native Irish. And so what you find that the Walters are mates with the Harolds, and what you find then, and what Magan notes, is that the lineage, these English settlers who've been here for centuries, are nearly indistinguishable from their Gaelic neighbours. Which I think is also why Brennan's Town is Brennan's Town, because it's, and you have the Irish word for Welsh even being incorporated, it's the Irish word for Welsh that's then anglicised into Brennan's Town and to Braddon, not the English word for Welsh, it's the Irish word, which is interesting, this kind of intermingling.
Assimilation.
But because, and Magan notes, there's no central authority, they're kind of being left out on their own in the Dublin Mountains, that equals to insubordination. But with the Walshers being of Carrick Mines, it is unsurprising that they were involved in the building of Carrick Mines Castle.
Yeah, and a fragment of the gable wall of Carrick Mines Castle still exists and is owned by Dunleary County Council. So Carrick Mines, in Irish, Carrick Mine, or Mian, meaning plateau of rock, with Mines being a corruption of Rock's map of 1785, in which he may have copied just Rath Mines. Now, the area still, at this point, is semi-rural, was historically on the border of the English control and featured a defensive construction, Carrick Mines Castle, which became the subject of national controversy during the building of the late stage of Dublin's M50 orbital motorway. Carrick Mines developed as a settlement in the more than 6 kilometre long valley of the same name, which contains the modest Carrick Mines River and its tributaries. The Ballyogan, Glenamuck and Gulf streams all merge in the vicinity. Downstream at Brennan's Town, the river merges with St. Breed's stream from Fox Rock to form the Loughlin's Town River, which in turn meets the Bride's Glen stream to form the Shangana River, which reaches the sea at Killiney Strand. Leopardstown lies to the northwest, Fox Rock to the north, Cabinteely to the northeast, and Brennan's Town to the east. Ballyogan to the west, Glenamuck to the south, and Lahan's Town to the southeast. Now, during the construction of the M50 motorway, Carrick Mines gained national notoriety when anti-road protesters, calling themselves Carrick Minders, set up camp in the area in 2004 and delayed the completion of the M50 for 2 years, with legal challenges being taken by Vincent Salafia. They were joined by preservationists, including Professor Sean Duffy, head of the Department of History at Trinity College Dublin, and Dr. Mark Clinton, who was the archaeologist employed by the National Roads Authority as site director. They argued that the site's potential for historical study had not been fully realised. They questioned why the line of the M50 rerouted through the castle in 1998, when the proposed new road was originally routed around it in 1983 on the advice of the state agency. The objectors claimed that the underground remains of Carrick Mines Castle, an Anglo-Norman fort built in the 12th century on the edge of the Pale, was of national importance. Today, much of the uncovered remains are preserved in tunnels and other structures scattered around the interchange, and Dunleary Rathdown County Council claimed the action greatly increased the cost of the project, which was eventually completed in August of 2005.
Yeah, so they did stem it for 2 years, but unfortunately it did go on ahead. And yep, just scattered around the interchange of the M50 are these little, very overgrown now, bits of foundations of Carrick Mines Castle. The mostly subsurface ruins then lay in the path of the M50 motorway, and sections of the medieval walls and some sections of the castle's defensive structures were preserved within or actually under the M50 roundabout. So if you're coming up towards, I know there's a new road now towards Carrick Mines Park, but if you're coming off the exit 15 off the southbound M50 and you turn on those big roundabouts that lead towards, if you're either going towards Cabinteely or if you're turning right and you're heading towards Ballyogan or you're heading up towards Carrick Mines, under those roundabouts is where the castle, so the M50 went absolutely right through it. So both Tim Carey and Tim O'Brien note that Carrickmines Castle was a site of a Hiberno-Norse settlement, which during the 12th century became a fortified Norman castle and village. On the frontier between Dublin and Wicklow in Ireland, guarding the southern plains, the fortress was once a central medallion in the necklace of the Norman castles. I love how Tim O'Brien has worded that.
Very poetic.
Mm, but it was this kind of it was very, very central in terms of this grand area, and outposts dotted along the outskirts of the Pale. It was one of the big ones, and the area around Dublin under English rule during the medieval period. In 1402, though, the O'Byrne clan of County Wicklow, who, as we mentioned, periodically raided Dublin, moved a large mercenary force to the banks of the River Dargle at Bray, but as a direct route of the city would bring them closer to the stronghold of Carrickmines, they apparently hesitated before attacking. The delay allowed the Walsh family who owned Carrickmines to send an urgent warning to Dublin, and the Dubliners responded decisively with the Mayor of Dublin and a large force who fell upon the O'Byrnes and defeated them in an encounter popularly known as the Battle of Bloody Bank due to the number of casualties. As a major fortress, it had an extensive curtain wall flanked by towers protecting an area of some acres, and within this was a settlement with a variety of wooden and stone buildings, mills and a keep or hall house right in the centre. The site actually still contains quite impressive defences, which, you know, you can still see in the bedrock, and there was human remains found when the castle was actually overwhelmed in 1642. And this is because of the Irish Rebellion of 1641. The Catholic Walshes, who owned the castle, sided with the native Irish, actually. And the Confederate then attempted to create the first independent Irish Parliament, but they paid for that dearly. Because a focus of the Irish Confederate Wars, the castle was then besieged by English forces, so they really honed in on Carrickmines Castle. And when it was retaken, over 300 of the Walsh, O'Byrne and O'Toole's were massacred. On March 26th to the 27th in 1642, Sir Simon Harcourt arrived from Dublin with 800 soldiers to lay siege to Carrickmines Castle, property of the Walsh family, as we mentioned, since the 12th century. And the Walsh family had harboured, of course, these rebels within the walls. Every man, woman and child in the fortification was either killed by sword or musket fire, and or were later put to death by blows from the butt ends of these muskets, because they found blunt force trauma in some of the human remains, with either the hilts of swords or the handles of hatchets. The bodies are buried in two mass graves on site, and although successful, Harcourt was actually mortally wounded and died soon after. So then, of course, the Walshes represent those strong lineages that they can trace as far back as the 12th century with the Anglo-Norman arrival into Ireland. But then the other side of that is the O'Byrnes, those people who were based in Wicklow, like the O'Tooles, who were constantly raiding and attacking these members of that lineage and these marchlands just on the very edge of the Pale, very edge of the border. And this actually brings us quite neatly back into Cabinteely. So, as noted by Dunleary Wet Down County Council, they've just done fantastic work around this area, so I would keep referring to them. Yeah. Of course, I'll put all the sources I've used from them and all the brilliant work they've done into the reading list. But Cabinteely House is actually an 18th century country house, and that is set in about 45 hectares of parkland, which is known as Cabinteely Park, which is what I would associate with Cabinteely if I'm ever going there. That, and there's a really nice coffee place called Urban, which is very nearby. But the house is quite an impressive 18th century staircase, decorative plasterwork and vaulted gallery. I would advise anybody, because they usually open it during Heritage Week or Culture Night, to go and have a look. But its refurbished stables have been turned into a very popular tea room, and the outdoor space also has a little adjoining Japanese garden. It's really nice to go and sit down in. But Cabinteely House was actually built in 1769 for Robert Nugent, and was subsequently owned by the O'Byrne family of Wicklow, and latterly then the TD Joseph McGrath. It came into the possession of the DLRCC, or the Dunleary Wet Down County Council, in 1984. Buildingsofireland.ie, who done great work on looking at these great architectural marvels, noted that it was a detached 9-bay, 2-storey country house. It was erected, as we mentioned, for Robert Craggs Nugent, who was MP, and he was the first and last Earl Nugent. So the architect was usually attributed to Thomas Cooley of Dublin, and it was confirmed by his attributes of making sure it has a deliberate alignment with commanding a fine view of the sea and surrounding country, which is kind of what Cabinteely does encapsulate. It's at the foothills of Dublin mountains, but you can also head down and see the sea from it as well.
Best of both worlds.
Absolutely. Very symmetrical frontage, centered on a pillared door case, good quality workmanship, this beautiful silver grey granite, urn topped parapeted roofline is iconic. If you're ever in Cabinteely Park, you'd know the house from a mile away. So having been very well maintained, the elementary form and massing survive intact together with substantial quantities of original fabric, both to the exterior and to the interior, where the contemporary joinery or classical style chimney pieces, you've got papier-mâché work and decorative plasterwork refinements, and this all highlights the considerable artistic potential of the composition. It is absolutely beautiful. It's so symmetrical when you look at it from nearly every angle, and inside is even more gorgeous. And then every building around it, all it's all in line with the building as well. So everything is symmetrically lined up. It is even all the outhouses and any of the outbuildings, like the nearby gate lodge, all sits in alignment to it. There's even a smaller little gate lodge as you walk out towards the parkland. And if you stand at that, you're actually directly opposite the house. So you kind of know where you are in the park at all times, using the house as a centre. So then it actually ended up passing into the O'Byrne family, which at that time was actually referred to as Byrne, not O'Byrne, by 1798. When he died, it went to his spinster daughter, so they never married, so then it just went through the daughters until it got to a one William Richard O'Byrne. And then eventually, as you said, latterly, it ended up in the hands of T.D. Joseph McGrath until it was handed over to the Dunleary Rathdown County Council in 1984. And the reason why I mentioned that at all, Camilla, is because 18th century big houses are something that you find all over South Dublin. And what you find, though, particularly in Cabinteely, Carrickmines, Loughlinstown, is that Cabinteely itself doesn't really come into its own until the 17th century. These kind of very open parklands and spaces are perfect, really, by the 18th century to build these big houses in. It is the perfect retreat. And as we mentioned right back in the Dundrum episode, right back in season one, all up around Carrickmines is all known as retreat area, spa area from Dundrum. And what you would find is that this was referred to as the countryside for Dublin. And so you're going to get these big houses built there. The Pym family, of course, built Brennanstown House, which is quite nearby as well. And of course, once you're in Cabinteely, it's very rare that you have extensive architecture still surviving, which we've noticed a lot of it is either getting pushed underground or getting completely destroyed by development. That is not necessary to say there isn't more extensive archaeology happening in the area, is there?
No, there is still loads of excavations taking place all the time. But again, a lot of them is in conjunction with big developments.
Mm-hmm.
But back in 2015, there was an excavation taking place in Cabinteely, and it uncovered a number of human skeletons of probable early medieval date. It was directed by Ken Wiggins on behalf of Judith Carroll and Company. Now, the excavation identified the remains of at least five individuals who had been interred in shallow east-west oriented graves. These newly discovered burials appear to be related to a large early medieval cemetery that was partially excavated at Cabinteely back in the 1990s by a team of archaeologists led by Malachy Conway. During this earlier investigation, over 15 Holman skeletons were found, we've already mentioned this, in a small area that measured just half the size of a tennis court. This enormous density of human remains was a result of over 700 years of accumulated burial activity that had commenced sometime during the 5th century. The majority of burials on Conway's site had been laid out in a supine position, on their backs, with their heads to the west, and many appear to have been buried in shrouds. Subsequent specialist analysis of the remains identified a variety of pathologies, many of which were suggestive of hard labor, intensive lifestyles. Like, this is what we already talked about. This is how people lived. Some more unusual burials were also identified at the cemetery, including an individual with a trepanated skull, a male who had been killed by multiple sword blows, and a pregnant woman who had sadly died during childbirth. Due to the limits of the original development site, Malachy Conway's excavation revealed only a small portion of a much larger burial ground, which appeared to extend into adjacent properties. The five newly discovered skeletons are located just a short distance from that original site, and it seems highly likely that they form part of the same cemetery. Hopefully, post-excavation analysis of the burials will confirm this hypothesis, but it's again, excavation is always a work in progress.
And of course, that was all brought to us by IrishArchaeology.ie. They usually write blog posts on these brand new excavations, but as you said, a lot more to be found in and around Cabinteely. And we'll be moving on finally into the 19th century and beyond, just after the break.
This is Dublin South FM.
So welcome back to Dublin's Historic South. I'm still here, and so is the lovely Camilla.
Thank you. I am.
And just before the break, I was saying, I was promising we're going to move into the 19th century and to more ruins. Of course, we're in the Cabin Teely, so yep. And what I'm going to move on to is Glen Druid, and the entrance gates to which were included as protected structures on the Dunleary Rathdown record of protected structures. And Glen Druid was built by John Barrington. So we mentioned this very, very briefly at the start of the episode in 1808. Barrington was actually a businessman and originally belonged to the Quaker tradition, but the original estate comprised of 126 acres to include the Druid's Glen, which was converted by Barrington to a pleasure landscape, which is ultimately where you find the Dolmen Tomb later, which is why it's referred to as Glen Druid's Dolmen as well. So Barrington planted trees, set out paths and constructed two cottages in the glen, and he also constructed a viewing tower, which the remains of which can still be seen, in 1818 to the west, which he called Tillian Tudlum, after the castle in Sir Walter Scott's novel The Antiquary. The structure was later extended and converted into a dwelling and is known as Barrington's Tower, and it's the ruins of which, along with the Dolmen Tomb, that, as I mentioned at the very, very start, the Glen Druid Dolmen Tomb public forum want to make sure there's still public access to, despite all the very modern, happening right now, house sales that are going on. So within the attendant grounds of the original estate was Brennanstown Dolmen, as I mentioned at the very start, and the Dolmen was actually located quite close to Carrickmines River. But what's also in and around the area is the Glen Druid Estate. The house itself is a 5-bay, 2-storey over basement with a projecting entrance porch and a bow on its eastern side. But it is set at an elevated site within its own mature grounds overlooking Carrickmines River Valley. It's accessed via the original gated entrance, which includes a single-storey gate lodge. And there's an interesting range of outbuildings to the rear of the house, which are accessed through a tall granite arch gateway. Or so they were, until now the lands have been developed, so now they're not as easily accessible. The site is bounded by a combination of high stone walls, all these trees and hedges, to give that sense of enclosure, and I wonder if they're going to try and incorporate that into the rebuild. Unfortunately, only time will tell. But Druid's Glen is the river valley within the grounds of Glen Druid, and that is an important element to the setting of the protected structure. The area contains a number of items of interest which have been identified in the Historical and Architectural Heritage Report, which was done by Rob Goodbody back in 2011. They include 2 stone bridges and a stone culvert. The original 19th century house is vacant and is in quite a poor state of repair, and this is of concern, but the best way to keep it is through active use, if we can, of course, get to it. And this is the big problem, which is why we wanted to kind of have an archaeology special. In terms of actually finding these amazing sites, keeping these sites, no matter if they're 19th century, no matter if they're 6,000 years old, how do we incorporate that into these grand developments? Should it be the public's right to go and see these, despite the fact that there's also the public's right to have houses built for them? It's a big debate. It's still ongoing. You know, you think that maybe after the likes of Woodkey, which you, I know you mentioned very briefly earlier on, Camilla, that this might have been settled. You think maybe even after 2005, when people are trying to push back the developments of the M50, this might have been settled. But now, 20 years later, in 2022, we're still going through it.
We are indeed. And it's part of the development. We can't stop progress.
Mm-mm.
But we also need to figure out a way to progress, but also protect.
Yeah, that's a big problem.
Essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, returning to the 19th century, one thing we see as well is the development of transport.
Mm-hmm.
Getting places. Yay!
Yeah.
Now, Carrickmines Station, which is located to the north of Priorsland House, was part of the original Dublin and Wicklow Railway, which is often referred to as the Harcourt Street Line, which ceased operation back in 1958. And the building, although vacant, is in a reasonable good condition and retains many original architectural features. One such feature is a former water tank, a remnant from the steam age. Now, while the station building remains, it has lost its original context. The line of the original track is now part of the extension of the Lewis Line B1. A number of associated elements were removed to make way for the Lewis Works themselves. And these include the original railway bridge that carried Glenamuck Road and the granite bullnose coping stones from the platform edges.
So as you mentioned there, Rob Goodbody did fantastic work on explaining the importance of this built heritage before they even were able to put that scheme into place. But it was between 2010 and 2016. And then, of course, the Lewis extension then was opened and you could head all the way out to Bride's Glen. But of course, now as we round up, come to the very end of the episode, Cabinteely, Loch and Sound Carrick Mines are all now known for either the Loch and Sound Hospital, there's Cabinteely School, you have Cabinteely Park, Kilgobbet Park. So intense residential development has happened, particularly in the last few years. But also, you also have the retail park, like Carrick Mines, or The Park, as it's called. And then, of course, the M50 and the Lewis, which, as you said, if it wasn't for this extensive development, most of the archaeology would not have been uncovered. What you're also finding is, particularly up around now towards, they actually have to move out further now. So up around, you're kind of hitting off Stepaside up towards Enniskerry, all up past the Golden Ball. That's now all been developed for residential. So all up along the Glenamuck Road, as you said, which originally would have just been an extension of that railway to get to Harcourt. Now you can still get to Harcourt via the Lewis. But the cost of living up around there now, Dublin 18, the prices have absolutely soared, because now, due to this extensive residential and commercial development, that area has now become quite sought after. And so what you find is anywhere from Sandyford out towards Bride Glen along that Lewis line, has the rent has gone through the roof. And now it's one of the priciest parts of Dublin to go and live in as well. But more development means more houses, means more excavations, means more archaeology for us to sift through. And I think on that note, as you said, big debate. Do you keep it and try and protect everything, or do you have to kind of sacrifice some of it in order to aid progression and development? Where does the line stop? Where does that debate
end?
And
where can we make sure it goes hand in hand?
Yeah, where does it work together? Which I think is why it's so important to have archaeologists, have historians involved in these strategic development zones. And I know that I was using the jargon throughout the episode, but I think that's important, because now it's not just a case of going, finding a hole and digging in it. There has to be almost a reason for it, because it's an expensive process. And yes, we learn so much and we uncover so much, but how many centuries we went, how many millennia?
But even in terms of conserving what we find, I mentioned with the Graves Moat that back in the 1930s, they found skeletons and just reinterred them. There was no archaeological report. Now we have all that because we have archaeologists attached to development projects like that.
And long may they stay, because they are absolutely important. Camilla, thank you so much. That was a cracking archaeology. I've always wanted to do an archaeology only episode, and I'm so happy that you agreed to do it. Thank you so, so much.
You're very
welcome. Usually we talk about archaeology at the start, and we kind of usually set the scene, and then we talk about the area, but this is archaeology heavy.
So all the way.
Absolutely. Thank you so, so much. And of course, if you want any questions for myself or for Camilla, you are very welcome to email me at dublinshistoricsouth@outlook.com. I'll provide you with the reading list and all those excavation reports if you want to sift through them as well. We had a great time doing it. You can follow me on Twitter at Dublin's Historic, on Instagram at ElfitzHistory, and Facebook at Dublin's Historic South. Thank you to Dublin South FM, who of course host the show, and the podcast episode will be available on the Friday after. See you next month.